Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Review, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone in the literary world. My guest today is author D. Allen Johnson. He has just published his third book. It's an interesting book, and Dave Johnson is an interesting man. Dave, it is great to have you on the program again.
Thank you, Simon. Thanks for having me.
You know, you never fail to amaze me. I would never have guessed that the buying and selling of heavy equipment would be a line item on your resume. I mean, is there anything in this world you haven't done?
Yeah, there's a lot that I haven't done, but I was very fortunate that I got to meet up with an old man that was an expert in buying and selling equipment. And in fact, it was my first job as a pilot. And this old man was, I think, 84 years old when he hired me to fly one of his airplanes. And he taught me a lot about buying and selling equipment. In fact, he made $43 million in just a few years buying and selling oil field equipment.
Wow. But how do you acquire the knowledge? I mean, obviously, I don't know a good bulldozer from a bad bulldozer.
Well, you know, you have to pick out a piece of the market. In fact, if you decided to do bulldozers, that's too broad. You've got to decide to do Komatsu bulldozers. And maybe just their two biggest pieces or their two smallest pieces to be successful, to gain the kind of knowledge about the product and the users that you need to really narrow down. I have a good friend that is only dealing in large, they call them conical stone crushers, and that's all he deals in. And so that's one of the secrets to success. Mr. DeArmond, the old man that I was telling you about that bought and sold oil field equipment, actually all he bought and sold was drill pipe. That's it.
Wow. So really the key here is you want to become a big fish in a very small pond.
That's exactly right.
Hmm. What sort of people get involved in this kind of industry?
Well, I think you have two types that get involved. You've got a guy that's an operator that knows the equipment. He learns it from working. You know, for example, he's been driving a certain piece of equipment for a while. He knows that piece of equipment. And just watching what goes on around him, he sees that they sell for cheap and that you have to buy one fairly expensive. The other kind of person, I think, is the kind that likes the idea of buying and selling. And they sort of come from the opposite side. I liken them to be hunters. They're hunting for a deal. They're looking for something to buy right and to resell for a profit, and they learn about whatever that piece of equipment is that they're going to. So from whichever end you come from, you need to learn the other guy's perspective in order to be successful.
My impression is that there is some serious money to be made in this industry, but you really need to understand the risks. What are some of the risks?
Well, I think the main risk you have is paying too much for a piece of equipment. From the day you own a piece of equipment, the meter starts running because you have a daily payout for storage, for interest, insurance, and what you might call your mental capital you're spending on that piece of equipment, because you only have so much time as an individual. And if you hold that piece of equipment for a couple of years, it can really cost you a lot of money. So that is your risk, is you pay too much for a piece of equipment and you can't get rid of it in the market. And when that happens, it's always best to take your loss quickly and move on.
Right. I'm guessing, and it really is no more than a guess. To be successful, you really need to understand what the buying market is up to at the moment. You know, you just want to try and turn the piece of equipment over as quickly as you possibly can. I mean, do you tend to go and look for buyers before you look for equipment?
Well, there's some people that do it that way, but you know, you're right that you're the top that you're going to get for the machine is what the current market is. You know, no matter how pretty you make it or how updated you do it, a certain piece of equipment is only worth a certain amount of money. And so in my book, I have worksheets set up. I mean, they're not formal, but I show how I do a worksheet. And the figure you start out with is what is the top amount it's going to sell for. You learn that by researching the market, what other people have sold pieces like that recently, and, of course, the equipment blue book. And from there, you go down. You take off what you're going to need, your holding costs, your interest, your maintenance costs, what you want to make in profit, and then you better put in a good piece of money for miscellaneous, those things that are going to come up that you're not sure what they're going to be, but you know something's going to come up. And then you never offer more than what you come out at the bottom of your worksheet.
I think the key here is know when to walk away.
Oh, yeah. It's not unusual to make 10, 15, even 20 bids before you get one. And it's always better to not own anything than to pay too much.
Mm. There's another risk that you mention in the book, and that is falling in love with something.
Well, yeah, you know, we talked about who gets involved in this kind of business. And I have a good friend of mine. I went to high school with him, and Stan is a good man. And he has grown up ever since he was a little kid loving heavy construction equipment. And he's gotten a job where he started out selling parts, but now he sells heavy construction equipment. And I mean, on his vacations, he goes to adult amusement parks where a man can go in and drive bulldozers and dig with big excavators. That's his form of enjoyment. Now, he has a risk of wanting to buy the biggest and best piece of, say, I know this sounds stupid, but he really likes Liebherr excavators. They're high-end excavators made in Germany. You know, they are the best in the whole world. And they don't sell very much in the United States. They're super expensive, but he has a weakness for them. He would love to own one all the time. You know, there's other people that are fall in love with their yachts. They're yacht dealers. They have always dreamed of owning big yachts, and they pay too much money. So you find people that especially in hunters and yachts, they want to own the best, and they pay too much money just for the bragging rights.
I see the boat business as being, you know, particularly susceptible to the falling in love syndrome. I used to do a lot of sailing out of San Diego, and you know, I'd go to these marinas and just look at these gorgeous boats, and you know, they were just money pits. You know, throw money at me.
Well, that's exactly right, and you know, a wise dealer understands that nearly all purchases are made on emotion. And
right.
Then you need to give a person some backup, logical information for them to justify their purchase. And the successful dealer will not allow his emotions to get in the way. And, you know, I have sold airplanes to people before, to top CEOs. And the close was to tell them, well, you know, so-and-so at this other business, he just bought a such-and-such type of airplane. You're not going to let him have a better airplane than you, are you? And the guy will grab the contract and sign. Because the bigger the purchase, the bigger the emotions that drive it. And
right.
And if a dealer allows his emotions to come into play, he is headed down the road to financial disaster.
Mm. Now, from your perspective, is it better to deal in bulldozers or the parts for bulldozers?
You know, that depends on the person. The parts business is very specialized in that you need to have an encyclopedic knowledge of the piece of equipment you are buying and selling parts for. But more than that, you've got to have an ability to organize, added to the ability to buy unbelievably cheap. The problem with the parts business is the people that are attracted to the parts business are normally what I guess you'd call a hoarder. They like to get stuff and pile it up and look at it, and they know what the value is of it, but they're not organized and they pay too much money for it. So the parts business is extremely specialized, and I've seen a lot more money, a lot more profit being made by the people that deal in the whole piece of equipment than those who deal in the parts business.
Mm. Now, you know, I can't say that I'm in love with excavators or bulldozers or you know, oil rigs.
That's just because you haven't driven some of those things.
Right, exactly. But, you know, I'll be honest with you. I don't know too many people these days that, you know, have $100,000 or more just sitting around waiting in their checking account. I mean, how on earth do you get funding for this, for these purchases?
You know, funding was the easiest part of this for me. And there is money available for people that have an idea and a plan to implement that idea. And I've never had any problem raising money. There's businessmen that have cash on the sideline that right now are getting 1.5% interest on it. And if you can show them a way that they can make a higher return with some ways that you mitigate their risk, they are willing to fund you. Now, for me, I was dealing in airplanes, so I usually dealt with businessmen who owned airplanes. They understood the value and the utility of a corporate airplane. Some would make the deal that while we own the airplane for resale, they got to use it in their business. And me being a pilot, I would throw in my pilot services. That I got away from that pretty quickly.
Yes, I can imagine.
Yeah. You know, the guy that I was in that airplane with, we had it for sale. He wasn't all that interested in selling it. He enjoyed using it every weekend, but we sold it at a profit, and I got out of that deal. But these people understand this type of business. And if I was going to go into, say, buying a large drag line for resale, for instance, that's a type of excavator that the bucket is on the end of a cable instead of on the end of a boom. And I would talk to men that had companies that had either used or understood the usefulness of a drag line. And you go to those men and you say, I can buy this drag line for this amount of money. They understand the profit margin there and what they would have to pay for it from a dealer. And I have had no exaggeration. I've had people lined up to do deals with me before.
Wow. The one source of funding that you haven't mentioned, but I'm guessing would be the cheapest money around. What about banks?
Yeah, once you get a little bit of experience, a little bit of a track record, you actually have bankers calling on you that want to loan you money. It was pretty nice for me. I'd have bankers take me out to lunch and try to convince me to move over to their bank and get a line of credit from them. And that's a nice position to be in. Banks are always looking for people who have a plan of action and a track record of achieving those plans in the order that they set out to.
I'm guessing the key here is you've got to have a business plan and you have to follow through on it. You know, once a bank sees that, you know, you're good for your word, if you will, that they're probably going to be a lot more cooperative.
Well, there it is, and you know you have to do the mating dance with the bank. I don't really know a better way to put it, but just like any other mating dance, you cannot seem to be too interested. You go in and talk to the banker, and you tell him what you're going to do. You tell him your plan and how you're going to buy a certain piece of equipment and how you're going to sell it. And then you leave. You don't ask him for any money. You whet his appetite. You come back in a month later, and you told him, hey, I bought that piece of equipment. I picked it up. I resold it. I made this much money. and would you like to go to lunch? So then, you never ask him for any money. And I hate to use this term, you string him along, continually telling him of the deals you've done. First you tell him the deal, how you're going to do it. And then after it's over, you tell him how it went, what changes you had to make, how you adapted, and how you overcame the obstacle and made money. And pretty soon he's saying, well, why don't you put in an application for the loan for the next one here?
Right. And you mentioned earlier the importance of, being a specialist, the big fish in the small pond. You're a pilot by trade. I've no idea how many different types of aircraft you've flown over the years, but I'll bet it's quite a lot. Now, as far as aircraft go, you seem to have specialized in Queen Airs.
Right. As I was starting out, I wasn't specialized at all, and I really didn't make very much money. But I got to know these guys that were the small air freight business, and especially in the South Texas and Mexico area, and what their needs and wants were, and they were needing short haul, a bigger airplane, pretty cheap. And the Queen Air met that bill, and after I had done one or two of them profitably, I specialized in that. There's only a few hundred of them ever made, and over the course of about 4 years, I owned a good number of them. One serial number I owned four different times.
I've got to admit, I love to fly. I'm not a pilot, and I like to think I, can recognize different types of airplane. And Queen Air is not a name that springs to mind. Is it related in any shape or form to the King Air?
Well, they took the old piston engines off, put turbine engines on, and called it a King Air. It is the direct ancestor to the King Air.
Oh, okay. All right. Now that puts it into some context. So, in a passenger configuration, it can seat what, like 8 or 10 people?
That's right. It has the same landing gear, the same wings, same fuselage, same cockpit layout. It's very, very similar.
Mm. And you said there were only, a few hundred made. I mean,
right.
That does sound like a very, very, focused market. I'm surprised that you were able to source them.
Well, no, actually, because everybody knew that I was the guy. So another airplane dealer, for instance, would take a Queen Air in on trade on a modern airplane. Well, he didn't know what to do with it. He'd call me and say, hey, this guy wants to trade in a Queen Air. What will you give me for it? And he'd tell me. So I would actually get lots of deals funneled my way. I would get airports call me and say, we've had this airplane abandoned on our ramp. Will you offer me anything for it? We've repossessed it for parking fees. Will you offer me anything for it? And so I actually had, since I was the one known in the world as the guy that dealt in these airplanes, I actually got a lot of calls on them.
Wow. I'm amazed. Was this in the days of the Internet or pre-Internet?
Well, pre-Internet, and then it started, right as I got out of the business, the Internet came on real strong. In fact, I started, I hate to sound so old, but I started before there were fax machines.
You are old, Father Time, the young man said.
Oh, isn't that the truth? But, the Internet has changed things, but not so much. People still need to get rid of a piece of equipment, and they might have a financial problem. I had a good friend of mine just the other day bought an entire plastic injection molding factory because a big corporation wanted to upgrade and they wanted to just move this stuff out. And he flipped it, made $200,000 in just a couple of days, but he was the guy, he's known in the world as the guy that buys this brand of injection molding equipment. This corporation didn't need to sell it. I mean, they weren't hurting for money. They just wanted it out of the way so they could install new equipment. I've had heard of other companies that want to get rid of a piece of equipment because it's the accountant said it's the end of the year. I want this off of my book. Sell it today. I've had other people call me and you know their wife has found out about their mistress and they need some cash quick to get a lawyer and they need to sell it today. It's just amazing why certain pieces of equipment sell.
All right, but this goes back to the whole funding question. You point out in the book, and it makes a great deal of sense to me. You've got to have that liquidity so that you can jump at a moment's notice. You can't afford to wait, you know, 3 weeks while a bank, you know, decides on if they're going to loan you money or not.
That's right. You know, if you look at the want to buy ads in these equipment papers, you know, just about every type of equipment has its own dedicated paper, whether it's boats or construction equipment or airplanes. Even rock crushers have a specialized magazine for them. In the back, you'll find a section called Want to Buy. And these different dealers advertise back there. And I always got calls because at the end of my want to buy, I put, I can fund within 24 hours. And I was the first guy they called.
Oh, I can understand that. I would imagine that from a buyer's perspective, your perspective, you know, you can offer a lower buy price, and still people will still get it because you're able to come up with the goods inside 24 hours.
That's right. I've had people call me that they waited until the last minute, thinking they were going to work out some way to save their company. And they've waited till the last minute, and the only way they can save their company is to pay off some debt, and the only way they can do that is sell their airplane that day. And so, you know, you're able to offer less. Of course, you know, you have a bigger risk closing in just one day. You've got to make sure all your ducks are lined up. And, yes, you can. It puts you in a great negotiating position.
I want to go back to this whole funding thing just for a second. In the book, I can't remember the exact words, but you have a rather terse comment about avoiding partnerships at all costs.
Yes, sir.
What? Why are you so sour on that approach?
Well, the a partnership is just like a marriage, and you need to really know who you're getting in partnership with. And you know, there's some very astute and powerful business people that will look over your business plan and offer you a certain amount of money for half of your business, for example. And, you know, they'll own half the business, you'll own half the business, and you'll get a big chunk of money up front. And, you know, as you go along, perhaps you have a shortfall of cash 1 month, and these guys will put in a little bit more money, and it'll take them from 49% ownership, say, to 51 or 52% ownership. all of a sudden you're no longer the president and CEO. You're a stockholder, and they take over. They're very astute, and they pay you a piece of the profit, but you might not even be employed in your own company anymore. And, that's the more complex kind. The lesser complex kind is, you know, you and one other person going to partnerships, and there's always some conflict about who does more work, who's put in more money, who's contributed more contacts. It's a partnership is only for very special people. For me, I did a lot better on my own.
Yeah, actually, I am in agreement with you. I had one minor, skirmish with partnerships, and it blew up before it even got started.
Yeah,
and it was very sad. It looked like the original marriage made in heaven. We had all the papers drawn up, we were good to go, and everything just crumbled.
Yeah,
I still can't figure out exactly why or what happened, but I did vow, okay, been there, done that, I'm not going to do it again.
Yeah, it's, to me, one of the great joys of being in business is not having anyone to report to. Now, if you have a joint venture partner, like I was talking about these businessmen that invest with you, you've got to make sure they get paid, and you've got to make sure you pay your taxes. Don't get me wrong, there's people still that you have to answer to. But when you make a decision to buy or sell, it's yours. You own it. And, if you decide that you're going to take a vacation for a week, that's your decision. You don't have to justify it to a partner. It's really a nice position to be in.
In the book, you allude to two different aspects of buying and selling. There's the choice of buying equipment that's in good working order and spending a little bit of money cleaning it up. In fact, I think you cite an example of an aeroplane where you had a guy come and wax and buff it, and it didn't look quite right, so you got him to do it a second time and a third time, and finally it was sparkly, and you just punted it, so I think your outlay for that was something like $750 or
right.
Thereabouts, or your other method is to buy something that's broken and beaten up, rebuild it, refurbish it, and then sell it. From a straight profit margin, it seems to me that, option one means that you're going to buy something for $80 and sell it for $100.
Right.
Whereas, option two is you're going to buy something for $10, spend $40 fixing it up, and then sell it for the same $100. What's your view? Is there a sensible strategy?
Well, I had I had an intersection in history where the Army was getting rid of their Queen Airs, and I was able to buy 10 very low-time Army engines for almost nothing. And so I got into the rebuilding business. Oh, the other thing is I had a very knowledgeable Queen Air shop very close to me. And so I had a confluence of things that happened, and I made a lot of money buying airplanes and refurbished them. And like I said, I'd get these airplanes that were repossessed or had been sitting on the ramp. We used to joke about it that I was resurrecting the dead. But in today's market, I don't know if I'd find that same intersection again of everything that came out right. And to start from scratch and say, I'm going to go into the rebuilding business and buy something that's, like you say, $10,000, put another $10,000 in it and sell it for $50,000. I don't know if I'd go that route. There's not as much competition. On the other hand, there's a lot more risk.
Well, yes, and there's also the issue that if you're going to rebuild and refurbish, then that $10,000 purchase is money tied up that you can't use elsewhere. And
right.
Money costs money.
Well, and you know, you really need to know your piece of equipment, because you might budget something and then you get in and you find out that you bought a money pit. And I had a very, once again, I had a great education. I had gone to school to be an aircraft mechanic for 2 years and worked as a mechanic for about 18 months while I was getting the last of my pilot's licenses. So I had a background that allowed me to the mechanical background to bid on these kind of projects and know what I was getting into. And there's not that huge surplus that there was a few years ago. The economy's gotten a lot leaner, and I'm talking about airplanes, although I think construction equipment and ships probably is on the other side of the coin. You'd have some opportunities there.
It seems to me with the economy and the shape that it's in, there's probably some really great deals in on the buying side of, let's say, small corporate aircraft. But I think the other side of the problem is not too many people are in the market to buy right now.
Well, that's not exactly true. Aircraft's sort of an odd thing. Corporations have become addicted to using their aircraft, and it's not nearly so bad a downturn as you would think. Actually, you can get more sales if you tell a buyer, why don't you let me pick you up in my jet and bring you to the factory? And you're able to attract a better CEO. That's one of the things they're going to look for is, you know, what kind of corporate jet do you guys have as a perk for me? And so the corporate jet market has not lagged quite as far as some of the other things. However, construction machinery, large ships like we talked about, mining equipment, all those things are really in the dumps, and it's a good time to buy that kind of.
where can people find your new book, which I don't believe we've even mentioned the title. So give us the sales pitch.
Okay, the title is Secrets of Buying and Selling Used Equipment. And it's available at Amazon as a Kindle download. If you want some of the other formats, you can go to usedequipmentsecrets.com and you can get downloaded. You can buy it there and download it as a PDF and as an ebook.
One of the areas that you talk about is the fact that we now live in a global economy. There are opportunities in countries outside of the U.S., but I think that there are also additional problems and risks, legal issues, you know, import, export, and all the rest of it. Is there money to be made in dealing abroad?
Well, I started off only selling airplanes domestically, but I sort of got dragged into the international arena, not really by my own volition. I had a Mexican mafioso come up and want to buy an airplane from me. And I didn't have the airplane.
This sounds like a Dave story.
Well, I didn't have the airplane that he wanted, but I was the only dealer around that spoke Spanish. I was right there on the border. His name was Don Pepe Contreras, and he had his Sicilian ambassador that, you know, kept him connected to the mob over in Europe with him, named Sandro Salvatore. And I said, well, I don't have one of those. And they said, well, we'll give you a $20,000 down payment. Pulled out a bag and gave me two blocks of $100 bills. So, I mean, that's sort of a start there, you know. I mean, it was a non-refundable deposit. All I had to do was come up with an airplane for them, which I did. And I knew who they were. I went to the feds and asked their permission to sell them an airplane. And they said, well, you know, we can't prove that he's done anything wrong, so go ahead and sell him an airplane. Believe me, I did everything on the up and up, but I made a good piece of money off of that. And then Sandro, the Sicilian, got me in touch with other people in Mexico, and that led to other deals in Central America. Then I started selling into South Africa and France, Italy. And the whole world is your marketplace. As things have opened up, I realized that equipment has a life cycle. It will get built and used in Japan or Northern Europe or the United States. And then after it becomes used up, it usually goes to Central or South America, East Asia for the Japanese stuff, and Africa for the European stuff. And it's a flow, and it goes down there, and it's usually used up until it's gone. For airplanes, for example, you can go to any African airport, and off the end, you can see all the dead airplanes that, you know, they just used up until they were worthless, or sometimes they crashed them. But it's the same thing for construction equipment and boats, mining equipment. And so if you get in that flow from the manufacturing countries into the end user countries, it's a huge amount of money to be made. So,
but I mean, there must be a lot of paperwork involved.
Well, you know, Simon, in anything you do today, there's a lot of paperwork involved. If you go to buy a car, you know, the amount of paperwork that's generated is huge. But but those dealers have a system. And it's the same way with an equipment dealer. You get an international lawyer and an accountant, and you make up a system for how you're going to do your paperwork. And once you get that system in place, it is replicated. You have it, you know, I mean, in today's world, you can have it on a little thumb drive. All your paperwork, fill it out, print it out on a little printer you carry in your briefcase, and you can make it happen. It's not that hard. It, of course, your competition, it limits your competition. People look at that and say, oh, I could never do that, when really all it takes is getting with a lawyer and a few emails and a few $100, and you generate the forms that you need for the different countries. And, you know, it's doable. It's not a huge thing. The secret for me is that I don't try to do it myself. I hire people that know about it.
I think that's the key. You rely on a knowledge base, if you will.
Right. The money that you have to spend for lawyers and accountants are worth it. They'll keep you out of trouble. They'll make sure that you pay your sales taxes and your transfer taxes and your import taxes, and you just add that on to the deal. And, of course, the main way to make money in selling overseas is providing financing. If you can sell on installment to places that don't have any credit, you become the king.
But your risk goes up.
Well, your risk does go up, but you know, we were talking about the equipment that is no longer considered valuable in the United States. It's considered obsolete. Say an old motor grader or an old tractor trailer truck. Considered obsolete in the United States, but is still very useful in a third world country back in the boondocks. And when you take a good deposit for something plus some collateral, remember, in every finance deal there's cash, collateral, and the character, the three C's, the character of the borrower. And you get good cash and good collateral from somebody that's got a good character, you'll do fine.
Okay. Well, you haven't quite persuaded me to get into the market, but you have this habit in your books of coming out with interesting little stories, and I have to admit that the one that caught my eye was the gentleman who turned up with a suitcase full of money. Do you want to tell us that story?
Well, in the book I talk about negotiating tips, and I tell you, don't ever go down on your price on the phone. Don't negotiate on the phone. It may be some other dealer just calling to see how low you'll go, you know, probing you, see what your profit margin and real sales price is going to be. But the other thing is, you're just giving away money if you're negotiating over the phone. I had a gentleman call me one afternoon about a Queen Air I had for sale. I was asking $55,000 for it. And he said, well, will you take $50,000? I said, well, sir, you know, I really don't discuss price over the phone. If you come down here and look at the airplane, then we can talk about the price. He says, well, okay. If I come down there and like the airplane, will you take $50,000 for it? I said, sir, you know, I'm not going to discuss price over the phone. He says, I understand that, but will you take $50,000 for the airplane? I said, look, sir, you show up on my porch with a suitcase full of money and we'll talk price. He said, okay, and hung up. So I figured it was some other dealer. You know, there's a guy over in California that I knew that also had a Queen Air. I thought it was him probing. The next morning, I go into my little office. I had a nice wide front porch with a smoker's bench outside. Guys could sit on the porch and smoke their cigarettes without smoking at my office. And on that bench, there sat this guy in a nice Western suit, you know, $1,200 cowboy boots. And he had the most beautiful head of white hair you've ever seen. He stood up, and he had an aluminum suitcase. And he said, "Hi, I'm so-and-so. I called you yesterday." I said, "Oh, yes, I remember you." He said, "Well, I have my suitcase full of money. Let's talk price." We went in. He opened his suitcase. It was full of brand-new $100 bills. He had hung up the phone that afternoon. He was in Las Vegas, gone to the bank, gotten $50,000 in cash, and caught the Red Eye airline down to McAllen, Texas, to meet me that morning. He was owner of a little casino there in Las Vegas. He opened the suitcase, and I counted the money. And he said, "Now will you take $50,000 for the airplane?" I said, "Yes, I will." He inspected that airplane for about 5 minutes and flew it back to Las Vegas that day. I kept in touch with him for many years until he passed away.
Wow. I mean, it is just a great story. Yeah, I'm waiting for someone to, you know, be sitting on my porch one morning with a suitcase full of money.
Well, you know, this business, you get to meet some of the greatest people in the world. You know, there's just not that many people that are out buying assets that, you know, run from $50,000 to $750,000. And I've gotten to meet, the governor of Louisiana, governor of Texas. I've met the head of major corporations. You know, I've gotten to eat lunch with the board of trustees of Tuskegee Institute. All these people that buy and sell this kind of thing, you get to know these people. Some of them who are quite famous and really nice people.
Yeah, I've actually found that in my line of work, reviewing, music and books, it's amazing the people you meet, and some of them become long-term friends, and I think back, when I was in my teens or early 20s, I looked at these folks as my heroes. I never dreamed that one day, that they'd be my friends.
And that's right.
They'd call you up just to chat.
Well, that's one thing we haven't talked about in being a heavy equipment dealer, is the ability of the dealer to connect with people, because a dealer stands in the intersection, the three-way intersection between people, money, and equipment. And he's got to be able to interface with each one well. And we haven't talked about those people skills quite very much, but a dealer's got to be able to negotiate, he's got to be able to have tact, and he's got to be able to be to instill trust in people.
Right, but you've also got to know when to say no.
Oh yes, there's an art form to turning down someone in such a way that a couple of weeks later, when they still haven't sold their asset, they'll call you back. You still you're still enough friends with that person that even though you told them, no, your asset's not worth that much money, they still feel comfortable enough to call you back and say, hey, you know, you were right. Is your offer still good?
I know that you're not involved actively at the moment, anyway, with this industry. Your true love is driving airplanes. Will you get back into it one of these days?
Well, I don't know. You know, I've had this disease, this love of flying, for many years, and I've just contracted another disease, and that's writing. And my wife says that I've become a completely different person over the last 2 years, because I enjoy sitting down and writing every day. I don't know if I would go back to it. I wrote this book because a friend of mine wanted to get in the business and asked me to give him a few notes. And when the notes ended up being 80 pages long, I figured, well, I better go ahead and finish it and call it a book.
And I actually think it's a great piece of work. For anyone that is considering getting into this kind of business, or in fact anyone that already is in it, I believe they could learn a lot from you.
Well, thank you.
Oh, and our time is almost up, but I do want to ask you this. I was watching the Discovery Channel earlier today, and they had a documentary on about an FBI agent by the name of Jack Garcia, who, under the pseudonym Jack Falcone, infiltrated the Gambino crime family. Were you on the Surviving the Mob show that I ran, where Jack Falcone, Jack Garcia was on the guest list?
Oh yes, I sure was.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Oh, and while I think about it, and Andrew's book, Surviving the Mob, went to print this week, and it's going to be in the warehouses next week. So that's going to be a cracking read. I've read The Galleys, so you will definitely want to read it.
Good.
In fact, I heard through a third party who shall remain nameless that Andrew's been a bit tied up with the witness protection program, but he is hoping to climb back on the radio in the not too distant future. So I'm hoping that you'll be joining us.
I'd love to.
That's great. Okay, we are just about out of time here. Dave, I really want to thank you for taking time out to talk to us today. And I really want to wish you every success with your latest book. And one last quick question. What are you writing next? So I can be forewarned.
Well, you know, my first two novels were about private military contractors, and my third one is a private military contractor that's been sucked into where the cartels were trying to buy a government in the Caribbean. It's based on a true story, and it's called The Grace Bay Agreement. I'm about 70,000 words into it so far, so I should be finished with it hopefully around end of January.
Okay, well, I will be looking forward to it. Dave, thank you again for talking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll talk again soon. Till next time, bye.
Bye-bye.